Monster Man, special episode, Lost Worlds. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Katie. If you'd like to be like Katie and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other levels, including monthly bonus content and every episode of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Katie, thank you very much for your support. And as always, I hope that you enjoy the show. Katie asked me to talk about Lost Worlds. You know the kind of thing, steaming jungles filled with dinosaurs, that sort of thing. And the archetypal Lost World is the classic D&D module X1, Isle of Dread. Now, I have actually already considered the Isle of Dread, but really in terms of the specific creatures that are in it, the Orania, the Phanaton, and the Rakasta, who are only a few of the many monsters in the Isle of Dread. I also covered them in the season on Creature Catalog, so that's season 5. I don't even know why I'm saying this. I didn't number them in those days, and I don't do it now, for that matter. I should. Anyway, also the sort of main bad guys of the Isle of Dread, the Kopru, are in that season as well. So, while I think I had some good things to say about those Isle of Dread monsters, I thought there was also more to discuss with the whole Lost World archetype. So let's start with its literary origins. Now, because of the name, I think the archetypal Lost World novel is The Lost World, written by Arthur Conan Doyle and published in 1912. Even if you've never read it, you know the premise. British explorers go to an isolated area where prehistoric animals still live, and then they get involved in some conflicts involving ape men. They have to escape. And when the hero gets back, he realizes that his girlfriend has left him, so he decides to go back to the Lost World and explore it some more. Yada yada. It is part of a larger genre that involves other adventure novels from around the same time period, right? So you could find parallels to the Lost World in things like Journey to the Center of the Earth, Tarzan, H. Rider Haggard's Alan Quatermain novels, the whole thing about finding a part of the world where the normal inhabitants of the world and the normal rules don't apply, often some kind of explorer, often, but not always some kind of a, you know, Victorian or equivalent thereof. These are novels that are rooted in the aesthetics, if not the realities, of colonialism. The idea of intrepid explorers going to dangerous, quote-unquote, uncivilized places, facing the dangers of the environment, facing the dangers of animals, and of course of the, again, quote-unquote, primitive people who inhabit them. This is the Dr. Livingston, I presume, world. A family tale says that we are distantly related to David Livingston. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Obviously, we find the colonialist version of this less palatable in the modern day. It's actually really interesting. You know, I've said this before, I'm sure, but I played at Grogmeet at one point a sort of superhero game, I think using Savage Worlds, set in the setting of the Kerberos Club, which is a kind of, well, I believe the Kerberos Club is Victorian, but this was like a prequel, it was Napoleonic, and we were going to help catch some like French agents who were trying to support Irish nationalists in the wake of the 1798 failed revolution in Ireland. And I was just looking at this thinking, I think we're the bad guys? But the game just assumes as its premise that maintaining the British Empire is a good thing. And I think that even 20 years ago, you could write a game like that and I think everyone would have just gone, well, yeah, that's the premise of the genre. You know, we don't agree with that necessarily, but that's the premise of the genre. And I think that's faded a bit today. Not completely gone, but I think people are more, not necessarily that people's attitudes have changed, it's what specifically they consider to be within those categories. So people would always have said, well, I'm not very comfortable with this game where you play Conquistador or something like that, or, you know, a Mongol invading Poland or something. And then now we're more likely to see the British Empire as being more akin to those things. Anyway, I think that one of the reasons that these Lost World things are popular is that we get to have the thrills of this kind of scenario, but without like that level of cultural and narrative baggage. That's what I mean when I say that they are rooted in the aesthetics of colonialism. Now, maybe the idea of, you know, mustachioed British explorers plundering a fictional landscape may still feel a little queasy, but at least they're not plundering a real landscape. Although having said that, I said that this idea was popular, but like, I don't know if it was that popular. There are a couple of examples that are around, right? Like, is the Savage Land still a thing in Marvel Comics? It was very big in the 90s and the 80s, I guess. Or like Monster Island in DC Comics, or indeed Monster Island in Godzilla movies. I honestly don't know. If you wanted to be really inclusive, you could say that the island in Lost is a Lost World setting. It doesn't have all of the same features, but it certainly has some of them, particularly the ones to do with accessibility and survival. So, what are those features? What makes this kind of world appealing? Why does it work? And I think it works particularly well in games. So the first quality of a Lost World, in my view, is that it must be remote and isolated. So the Lost World in the Arthur Conan Doyle novels is on a remote mountain plateau. Tarzan lives deep in the jungle where people seldom come, although they do sometimes. The Isle of Dread, of course, is an island. The Savage Land is at the South Pole. It's not easy to get in or out. Now, this has multiple functions. Obviously, in something like The Lost World, it serves to explain why this landscape hasn't been noticed by the Edwardian press. But that's not a concern for the Isle of Dread, which exists within a fantasy world. Indeed, that fantasy world is largely outlined in the Isle of Dread. Oh, there's an island full of monsters? Yeah, no kidding. Every island's full of monsters. The world is full of monsters. Although it does explain why no one has plundered any of the treasure yet, or why no one off of the Isle of Dread can tell you anything very useful about it. But even if you don't need a place within an otherwise explored landscape to put this, you know, you don't have to put it in the center of the Hollow Earth or whatever, because if it existed on the surface, people would know what it was. Even in a fantasy setting where you don't have to do that, their remoteness is still useful. The protagonists are on their own. They have to solve their problems with the resources that they have to hand or the resources that they can find in the environment. And I think that it's no coincidence that the Isle of Dread is X1. It's the scenario that comes in the expert box set, and in some ways it's meant to teach you how to run wilderness adventures. And as a result, it's a hex crawl, but it is a hex crawl with some limitations. The PCs don't have total freedom of action. They have not necessarily a constrained starting point, but they certainly have like more likely starting points, and they can't just go back to town to refresh supplies frequently or hire support. If they have a base, they are cut off from it. So this takes that version of wilderness exploration and contains it and simplifies it a little bit. I do wonder if this doesn't work as well in 5th edition, because that is actually kind of the 5th edition norm. The whole sort of expedition management aspect of early D&D is not particularly present in 5e, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Certainly not my favorite part of the game. But a 5e character in general would not be too concerned about a lack of resources. Solving problems with the powers and abilities on their character sheets is sort of the default mode for these characters in the first place. Next up, the Lost World is savage. Now, I don't know what this means in terms of somewhere like the Isle of Dread, but I still think it's relevant. But outside of the Isle of Dread, what I mean is that typically the Lost World is contrasted against the civilization of the protagonists. So when the X-Men are in the Savage Land, they don't have their computers, they don't have their plane, things don't necessarily work like they expect, they don't speak the language, and if they're rogue, they even wind up in a primitive, i.e. pinup, version of their costume. Although, having said that, in fairness, at least some of the time, so does Wolverine, who seldom needs much prompting to get his shirt off. So they are out of their normal context. Now, the X-Men obviously are characters you can't call the cops very much, but they can't even look stuff up on the computer. In fact, having said that, I don't know how this connects to the Isle of Dread, you can actually see this even in the Isle of Dread, where the theme of savagery is maintained. And I think I talked about this in the episode about this module. The theme of savagery is maintained by those three main NPC factions, the Orania, the Phanaton, and the Rakasta, because they are all kind of animal people. The Orania are spider people, the Phanaton are monkey people, and the Rakasta are tiger people. So the Arania are weird and alien, and it sort of makes sense that they're spiders, or at least, you know, they should be bugs of some kind, because being weird bugs is kind of their deal. But the Phanaton are basically arboreal nice guys, and the Rakasta are proud tribal warriors. So there's no reason that they couldn't be humans or elves or whatever. They're animal people because it's more like primal and savage. It's thematic. And that contrast between the savagery of the Isle of Dread and civilization works even though the characters may not be from places that are particularly quote-unquote civilized. It works because, as I always say, the themes of a game are intended for the understanding of the players, not the understanding of the characters. Speaking of creatures, you would think that if we are in a savage world, not a savage world, but just a world that is savage, then the main villain would be the most savage creature of all. But actually, that doesn't necessarily apply to most villains in Lost World settings. Sometimes the villain can come from within the, like, expedition, you know, can be one of the protagonists who turns on the other. But in the Savage Land, in the X-Men, the villains are almost always people who come in from somewhere else on Earth 616 to exploit the mineral resources of the Savage Land, which is the other place on Earth that you can find vibranium other than Wakanda. Although I believe it's a different kind of vibranium. I couldn't tell you. Anyway, the villains that turn up are either like would-be exploiters like that or would-be conquerors. Even Sauron the Pterodactyl Man, although he spends a lot of time in the Savage Land, he's not from the Savage Land. He's a hypnotherapist from Argentina. He's named Sauron after the baddie in The Lord of the Rings. Is just a total coincidence that he turns into a pterosaur when he consumes the life energy of mutants. I'm not making that up. Anyway, as a doctor, Dr. Carl Lykos, he is a more like intelligent, cerebral character whose plotting and villainy are contrasted with the sort of animalistic savagery of the Savage Land. The same arguably goes for the villains in the Isle of Dread, the Kopru. They are probably the most intelligent creatures on the island. In fact, they are so intelligent that they view the adventurers who entered their sanctum as no better than pawns to be used for their agenda. And they got mind control powers to go along with their sort of elitist dominating attitude. They view humans, or half-elves or whatever, as beasts, which of course fits in with the idea that the PCs are the ones who we initially read as civilized characters cast adrift in a world full of beasts. Even the people are beasts. And indeed, if you want to succeed with the Rakasta or the Phanaton, maybe not so much the Arania, it helps to not judge by appearances. If you can look at them and go, oh, these are the villagers, and not necessarily think of them as animals, then you'll do well. Which is why I think also they can't just be humans or elves, because they have to feel strange to the PCs who live in a world where fantasy creatures are not uncommon. Of course, today, you know, again in 5th Ed, where playing a weird fantasy creature is a big part of the appeal of the game, I don't think that would be so true. So let's take a look at an example set of monsters, because this is a monster podcast, and I'm interested in looking at the ways in which monster palettes, the term that I've used before, are used to underline the themes of this kind of module, which is typically, but not always, some kind of hex crawl. So one instance of this that's been done well recently, in my view, is the Isle of Ix by Skullfungus, which I bought at Dragon Meat 2022, I want to say. I read it and I really enjoyed it, but I haven't looked at it in a while. So let's take a look at its monster section and see how it lines up with my predictions. Now, the Isle of Ix has like a monster appendix. It also has the monster appendix, I think, covers monsters that are types that you might like run into on the random encounter table. There are also unique monsters and NPCs scattered throughout the book. I haven't bothered to look too much at them, but just in the bestiary section, there are a couple of different categories. So we start off with humans, but also we do have some intelligent animal people. These are the fish people. I think they're called drowned ones. They're clearly a bit like Lovecraft's deep ones. And again, although they are menacing and people will tell you to be afraid of them, you can talk to them and they can be reasoned with. There are also mutants who have sort of random weird powers. And again, they live kind of as, you know, swamp-dwelling outcasts. We are the mutant race. Don't look at my eyes. Don't look at my face. That kind of thing. Then we get a section of dinosaurs About 25% of the bestiary monsters are dinosaurs. And there are some unique dinosaur antagonists as well, like there's a big albino T-Rex that you have to tangle with at one point. Then there's some other dangerous wildlife that's weirder and kind of like reinforces the theme that mysterious forces on the Isle of Ix are causing things to mutate. And then there are some space aliens and the weird high-tech constructs that they brought with them. And again, the structure of the Isle of Ix, like, the Isle of Ix is a hex crawl. You can do its bits in any order. They all kind of, like, web link back to each other. So each of these, you know, the Isle is not that large. Different factions may live in quite different biomes. They may have quite different agendas, but they often have clues or questions or quests, I suppose, that lead to other parts of the map. But typically, the way it's going to work is that you're going to land, you're going to deal with the dinosaurs and things as you try to survive in the jungle, you're going to make contact with one or more of the civilizations, and so you're going to be at this kind of base level where you're dealing with bandits and dinosaurs and whatnot, until at the end you're encountering the aliens and alien-related ideas and environments, and then you want to use things from those environments to solve the fundamental problem you have, which is that you were shipwrecked on a desert isle and you're surrounded by a magical storm and you need to figure out a way to get through the storm. You'd be wrecked even if you had a boat, which you don't. But so we go through this structure of the familiar genre of shipwrecked sailors trying to survive on a jungle island, and then eventually we get to strange ruins of the space gods, which is another classic pulp fantasy element, but maybe not the one you were expecting in your Lost World. Although ancient ruins in the Lost World are pretty common tropes, which is just another way of saying that even in fantasy worlds, people get archaeology and paleontology mixed up. So the structure of this type of Lost World, and this is arguably kind of also the Isle of Dread, the structure of these hex crawls, insofar as they have structures, is one of alienation followed by reintegration, but that reintegration is a twist. So you get to the reintegration, you're like, okay, cool, exploring dungeons, picking up treasure, dealing with intelligent creatures, these are all things I understand, these are all things we're used to, but actually these civilized, or even super civilized, super intelligent creatures are a problem of a different kind. You discover that there's more to it than just a big island full of monsters. But in order to do that, you have to get through the big island full of monsters. There's ancient ruins in Tarzan as well, now that I think about it. I'll tell you the truth. Although he is a towering figure in the history of pulp fiction, I have not read very much Edgar Rice Burroughs. I've read a couple of John Carter books. I mean, they're very short, and I've never read a Tarzan book. But my understanding is that Tarzan is one of those heroes whose adaptations are very, very different from the source material. And the source material is more this kind of H. Rider Haggard adventure story. And then the adaptations are like, well, what if there was a man who lived in a jungle and he had a friend who was a chimpanzee? And this was a good way for us to have all the like landscape and wildlife of Africa while still having a protagonist who was a white guy, times being what they were, and then also to cast some real buff dudes and have them run around in loincloths. I'm just saying, I don't think it's very like a Tarzan novel. But the idea that these kinds of wild places were associated with ancient mystery, again, I think is because we're conflating all those elements, right? Like, to us, the explorer slash detective model of adventuring is there, whether what you're exploring is nature or ancient civilizations, right? They kind of blend together. If you look at the lists of, like, historical people who were cited as inspirations for Indiana Jones, I mean, the majority of them are archaeologists, but far from all, some of them are naturalists of various kinds. I think Roy Chapman Andrews is one of them. These distinctions matter to people who do these things, but plunging into the unknown in search of knowledge is the main idea, and the specifics of the knowledge don't matter from a pulp perspective. The premise of Isle of Ix, being in a shipwreck is one of the ways you can get onto the Isle of Dread, but the premise of Isle of Ix very much starts with you're in a shipwreck, and therefore you could be anybody who has a good reason to be on a ship, which is to say, almost anybody. So I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff that you can do with the Lost World. I do think that it's a little bit constrained. Well, not constrained. I guess I just mean, like, it's good for certain things. That sense of exploration of the unknown is interesting because it's a familiar unknown. The steaming jungle full of dinosaurs is almost comforting in its familiarity, despite the fact that its whole point is to be this weird contrast. So partly it's the aesthetics, partly it's, you know, having people tell you that the guides will go no further today, they say this place is cursed, partly it's dinosaurs are fun and cool and you like engaging with them. But I do think that there's a limit in terms of, I don't want to say what kind of stories you can tell, because something like the Isle of Dread is very much not a story, but there are certain experiences that you can have, and there are certain ones that you just really can't. And Lost Worlds produce focused gaming experiences. They focus on certain types of play, which is one reason maybe that big campaigns in a Lost World hex crawl might fizzle out, because the Cornball D&D fantasy world, although like it doesn't make a lot of sense in many ways, what it's for, the reason it doesn't make any sense, the reason it is what it is that it needs to facilitate a wide range of different gameplay experiences. And things like the Isle of Dread, they're a little bit more limited. There are certain things that you just can't do in that Lost World environment, which is part of what people like about them, but also it is something that can restrict how long you enjoy playing them. I don't know. That I'm speaking totally from speculation. I've never played one of these campaigns for a long time. I would like to run Isle of X. You know, I'll put it on the list for games people can choose between when one or the other of my current games ends. But so those are my thoughts on Lost Worlds, with a little bit of a touch on the monsters that appear in them. Katie, I hope that was useful to you. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, Katie, thank you very much, as always, for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode, maybe found it useful. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Katie and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning to our journey through the monsters of Athas, the post-apocalyptic fantasy world that is home to the Dark Sun AD&D setting. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.